ทุสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ
Reflecting on the conditioned world, and then reiterate the meaning of world in Buddhist terms means what we create out of ignorance in our minds. So in that way, in some sense, we each create our own world. That's why I was saying that we are the center, and we can create a totally false and deluded world based on fears and desires. Or we can not create anything out of fear and desire and be the knowing of the flow of life, the way things are. This is what we mean by refuge, to let go of that basic delusion in which we create and compound the present moment always with something of our own, out of our own fear and desire. We actually have a choice. We can be just the conditioned creatures, the Pavlovian dog, or we can choose not to be. We can be enlightened beings. So this is what we're here for, I hope. But you don't want to become a conditioned, I mean, you know, slightly better than salivating when the bell rings, but not much. Is when we're when we have this opportunity to transcend the conditioning process, which doesn't mean we get rid of conditions, but then there's the insightful knowing and perfect understanding of Dhamma, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. Now when we look at, say, at these flowers, these lovely chrysanthemums, as something, say, when we project something onto it, then we're creating something that is extra to the actual existence of this plant. But so that we might believe that the word chrysanthemum is somehow what it really is, that because we call it that, we think maybe that's the reality of it, is it's a chrysanthemum because you have a name for it, isn't it? That's rose, chrysanthemum, then we really know what it is now because we have a label, a name that we give it. What if it was some kind of flower that we'd never seen before? I wonder what kind of flower that is, because we wouldn't. The tendency of the conditioned mind out of ignorance is always to put a name onto something, fit it into a conditioned category, so that if it looks like is this kind of rose-like or chrysanthemum-like, but it's not exactly. It looks like one of those, maybe it could be something from Australia, the different kind of flora there, and we go on speculating about it. Wanting to give it a name, but as Dhamma, it is what it is, isn't it? When the eye contacts this plant, it's just this way. That's consciousness. There's beauty in consciousness, isn't there? It's a beautiful plant, so beauty is there. But we're not that immediately. We think, isn't it beautiful? And then we go on and with that kind of thinking, then we tend to no longer really be with its beauty, because we're we're saying something about it, we're adding something on to it, which usually conveys one's own opinion and one's particular bias and view. You know, well, I've seen more beautiful chrysanthemums than that. I was at the garden show the other day and saw a much better chrysanthemum than this. Well, I don't like chrysanthemums. I much prefer roses. Whatever, there's something extra added on from our own personal world that we create. But when the mind is, when we know the difference, when we see the Dhamma, then we see the Dhamma of beauty and it speaks to us in its own right for what it is. We're not expecting it to speak from the position of being the most perfect chrysanthemum ever grown on this planet. But from whatever it has to offer, it's offering to us. We're receptive to its message in whatever state it happens to be in. Like now, these roses aren't so beautiful now today, are they? Pretty droopy. Yesterday they were vibrant like that. Now they're like that. So when we those roses have had it. Throw them out. Anything I can't stand is a wilted rose. They don't like roses. Never last very long, do they? Not like chrysanthemums. Chrysanthemums just seem to stay that way for ages and get tired of them. But but even in its droopy stage, it's still, if we're not caught up in our own world, creating a world, our own views around it, then also it has something it's offering to us through consciousness of it. Because the whole process of from birth to death, from the arising to the maturing, to the full flowering, to the fading, to the rotting and all that, that's all Dhamma to us when the mind is free from this creating a world out of desire and fear. And then when the mind is free, then everything is Dhamma for us, the whole process of life. Evil is Dhamma, and good is Dhamma, and birth, newborn babies, and old, senile people, and cripples, and healthy people, and men and women, and everybody, everything is Dhamma rather than something that I have strong opinions about and prefer this over that. On a personal world that we create, then we have strong opinions about all kinds of things. You can see we live in a time where people really express all their opinions quite openly. So we have, you know, endless conflicts and disagreements because people have different ways of looking at things. And then the opinions, you know, differ. And then we become angry and upset over, we're fighting from two different worlds. Sounds like one of those soap operas, doesn't it? We come from two different worlds. I remember seeing one of a Chinese film when I lived in Southeast Asia. They're kind of melodramatic Chinese films produced in Hong Kong. Story of this Chinese artist who falls in love with a Japanese woman, and the classic line was, "It can never be. We come from two different worlds. You're Japanese and I'm Chinese." No, in a way, that's true. When one is putting emphasis on those kind of issues, then there is definitely two different worlds we have to deal with. And if we don't know that, then we tend to be endlessly frustrated and annoyed by life, because we somehow think maybe our world is what everybody's world should be. The way I see everything is the way I assume everyone else sees everything, or should. And then you feel angry or upset or indignant by the fact that people don't always see it or agree with the way you see the world or the world you've created. Because the real world, the quote, real world, unquote, is our world, isn't it? When people talk about, say, accuse us here, the Samanatharamavati, of not living in the real world, it means that we don't live in their world, which is real for them. That's what they mean, isn't it? Because they regard their world as real and our world as not being real. But any of the worlds are unreal. They're all illusory worlds. Because then when we see in the right way, then we see Dhamma rather than create a world. We can still use conventions, but the conventions then are coming from wisdom rather than from ignorance. So one can still use the English language and English conventions and so forth, but it's then not just a habitual conditioned reaction to life that we're using social conventions or language, but it's skillful use of these conventions for what is true and good and beautiful, rather than to divide and separate and create endless delusions around ourselves and in the minds of others. Our minds tend to be very conditioned with ideals, so that we expect a lot from life, actually, most of us, because we have these ideals. And this is just a reflection for you, so you can contemplate your own what suffering is for you. If this helps, then use it. But like the ideals that we have for how life should be. It's like democratic systems and communism and socialism are all based on very high-minded ideas. Even though one has been brought up as an American, which means you are brought up to hate communism and regard it as the focus of evil in the world, think it's just totally evil. Actually, when you examine communism and what it was its original purpose and what Marx had in mind, it's very idealistic. I mean, it's to try to bring a kind of perfect society into being, perfectly equal and fair society into being, where nobody is preferred, everybody is equal, and all things are shared, and there's nothing. You know, eventually to that ideal state where we're all, perfectly happy, living in a perfect society where everything is perfect and there's no unfairness, injustice, inequality at all, say the ideal goal. But then look what happened when it was imposed upon a country of people. A group of people. And it became a tyranny, didn't it? Rather than being a liberating system, it became an oppressive one. Why? Why didn't it liberate when it's based on such high-minded views and ideas? And then we realize that high-minded ideas, if imposed on anyone, become a tyranny. Just like morality, isn't it? What we most fear about the word morality is the kind of old puritanical Victorian version where you have to keep you have to be moral, otherwise God's going to punish you. Fire and brimstone, eternal damnation, most horrendous things that God does to you for being immoral. So if you really want to get out of that, you have to be moral. So that even though morality is a good thing, it becomes oppressive. We feel oppressed by it. Everybody's telling us what we have to do. And we don't know how to cope with our feelings or instinctual nature at all. We're just told that, say, like sexual desires, or this is wrong or bad or dirty, or that these impulses we feel and so forth are evil, and if we follow them, the devil's going to get us and we're going to burn for eternity in hell. So morality becomes moralistic. Rather than a liberating convention, it becomes something that oppresses us, something that makes us kind of frightened and hypocritical about everything. Because we might be doing those things, but we don't want anyone to know. Everything is under cover, behind the curtains, and the pretense of being moral and upright is what we show to the world. You know, the image is because we don't want to be criticized or threatened by the vicar or the neighbors, you know, watching out through the curtains, the lace curtains, to see who went in the house and who comes out early in the morning and all this. So so that we people are looking. When you've been oppressed by morality, you can't help but get a kick out of watching other people be immoral. <can't you? laughs> Not much, you know, you really can't do it as a kind of honest kind of enjoyment of pornography. You have to kind of do it in a kind of, you know what I saw? Isn't that disgusting? Dreadful. Isn't that disgusting? What did she do again? Isn't that disgusting? You know, at that time, we were all pretty high on being disgusted. That's because it becomes a kind of hypocrisy. And that's what we feel it's dishonest, isn't it? We feel it's oppressive. Morality then is tainted with that kind of perception. But when you're presenting morality as a reflection and as a way to understand things, then we see it as something that helps us. And that's what it's meant to do. It's meant to be a help for us. It's a tool for helping us to develop and act in the right way, in ways that are skillful and good and a benefit to ourselves and others. So then we enjoy it. We love morality because it's happy. It makes us respect, it allows us to respect ourselves and to feel good about our lives. And it's not oppressive. It's not, doesn't bring out mean and nasty and states of mind or hypocrisy, because it's coming from the heart, from an understanding of its use and its purpose and an appreciation for it. Because even though we've made evil look like it's very tantalizing, and that somehow you I remember in my youth they used to have pop songs on the radio where some kind of vampish voice would come out singing about how I want to be evil, or I want to, you know, this kind of attractive glamour of, around evil, fascinating and interesting, and of course one, when you're young, you think, yeah, evil is a lot more interesting than goodness, isn't it? I mean, it's something about doing something sinful is kind of exciting. But doing something good doesn't excite you, because in our society, sin and evil, these things, immorality, is oftentimes made to even appear quite glamorous, and it's a way to really assert yourself and be free to do all the things that nobody else dares do. But on further reflection, when you reflect on evil actions, and that, then you realize that there's that evil thoughts or evil actions or speech, there's something in us that we can't respect. We lose respect for ourselves, and we create a life around. We create division and mistrust around us. How can you trust anyone who is immoral? Isn't it? Your measure of trust falls away, and confidence in them, because say just the second precept of stealing. How can you trust anyone who you know steals? It might be they might be proving their free spirits to do what they want, but in a society where you have to live with each other, all you can do is feel when a thief comes into the room is, did I put my did you lock the door? Because they create around them that feeling of mistrust, and then their self-respect also is, they have no way to respect themselves because they've not done the thing, they've not acted and lived in a way that is worthy of respect. And so they tend to create just problems wherever they go, difficulties around themselves. Whereas, say, a moral life is done in such a way that we find a joyousness in it. It's not boring and dull and just for kind of silly old people are afraid to do evil because they might be sent to hell by the devil. It's not just the kind of wimpish straits of the world that that are good, but it's goodness has a beautiful result. It brings joy into our lives. At least I find it so. To be good is an honor, and it's something that one loves to do the good, and one feels grateful that one can do good, that one has the opportunity, the occasion, and the possibility for doing good things. And then one reflects on the result of things that one has done that are not good, and it leaves an unpleasant memory in your mind, doesn't it? We have to experience the guilt and remorse, and also the karmic result of that comes up and might overwhelm us in our lives, just having lived selfishly or foolishly, and then we have to bear the consequences of the karma of those actions. But good actions always leave a good result. So I mean, in immediate terms, if just thinking a good thought makes you feel good, if you're really aware, if you're really thinking good and meaning it, at that moment you feel very good, because the result is that immediate. And then as we live in a way that we respect ourselves, then people will respect us, and people like to have us around. People enjoy having good people to live with, unselfish, kind, generous people to live with. It's a joy, it's a pleasure to live in a community where people are that way, like here in the monastery. It's a very pleasant community to live in, because people are really value that goodness, and they try to be very good, and they're very generous and kind. So, and this is a very pleasant, because of that, it's a very pleasant community to live in. One is doesn't find it a place, like I travel a lot, and I always enjoy, look forward to coming back here, to being with the monks and nuns again. I enjoy their company, I enjoy living with them. Where if they were a bunch of quarreling oafs, I'd do everything I could to stay away. It wouldn't be nice thought to have to come back here, and everybody kind of at each other, and in fact one is trying to figure out how to stay here more, because I'm getting older and I'm not particularly love traveling anymore, but the more I figure out how to stay here, give more time to Amaravati, the more invitations I get to go away. Respecting yourself is a necessary ingredient for the holy life. And in America, I was noticing how many idea of self-respect oftentimes comes not through any real understanding or living in a way that you respect, but in going to psychoanalysts. So you get in California anyway, people who are endlessly going to therapies and through psychoanalysis, so that they can like themselves, so that they tend to spend lots of money and do all kinds of things to have the feeling I really love myself. And people will come out like that. They don't so prone to talk like that here in Britain, but in California, then somebody will come out and tell you, now so you don't even know their name. They say, "I really love myself." Who's that? Well, I really like myself. It's more like they're trying to convince you of something than the real kind of respect for yourself. But just endlessly thinking about yourself and figuring yourself out in concepts, in words, through analysis, can be of help in one level, but it does not allow you to respect yourself. As long as you're paying money to a psychiatrist to sit there and listen to your endless regurgitations of your problems, and all you're thinking about is yourself, and then my father, my mother, and maybe you're working hard to pay, because the psychiatrist is very expensive, so you're making lots of money to pay this man or woman to listen to you for an hour, once or twice a week, but you still are going to be left without self-respect, isn't it? Because that's not worthy of respect, is it? To sit around and talk about yourself and your faults, and expect somebody else to kind of do something for you or that. So what is worthy of respect? What is it that you really respect in yourself or in others? And so this is how I see it anyway, is like being moral is worthy. I respect people who really are moral and good, who try to refrain or restrain themselves from doing harmful or saying harmful or divisive things, who are trying to not act on malicious intentions or selfishness. Those kind of people I respect. And when I'm like that, I respect myself, even though there's no self. But on a conventional level, I respect that when I refrain from doing and acting in selfish ways, and in ways that cause harm or disruption or confusion to others, or out of conceit or pride and stupidity. Being generous and kind, isn't it? When we give things to others, and out of just loving to help and serve and make offerings to others, then that I respect. That in me which loves to give to others and serve others, I respect that. I don't respect myself when I think others should be serving me. You should be serving me. And what have you done for me? Look at all I've given you. What have you done for me? And that kind of thing is not worthy. I don't respect that, even though sometimes those thoughts are not absent from my mind. They, it's not anything I respect in myself. I mean, that I would want to say, follow that up and make my and think of myself as being worthy of somebody else's respect. So, say in the basis of religious life is the dana sila or the generosity, charitableness, and morality are the very foundations of the holy life. Because this is where, when you're kind and generous, unselfish and moral, then you find you'll have a respect for yourself. You won't have to go to a psychologist and try to think to yourself that you love yourself anymore, because you can actually like yourself or respect yourself because of the way you're living and what you're doing and how you're living your life is worthy of respect. So that's a reflection on how to respect yourself, the importance of that as a foundation for liberation, enlightenment. Now ours is a time where we tend to demand rights. This is the age where everybody's demanding their rights. So everybody is going over the top demanding rights. And everybody thinks they have rights and is demanding them. So, but this is not really worthy of respect, is it? It's understandable that everybody should want rights. But as an actual mental thing in your mind, when I think, I have my rights, I want my rights, and this I listen to that and I don't particularly respect it, because I don't like the sound of it. It's not something that arouses inspiration in me when I hear it in others or in myself. What inspires me is what can I do to serve? How can I help? What can I offer? Like when somebody comes into Amaravati and they say, what can I do to help? What can I offer the community? That's something you say, oh, that person is really glad to have them. Somebody comes in here demanding their rights, you think, what a pain in the neck. So, so you really see that demanding rights for yourself maybe have its point, but as a religious path, it doesn't work. We don't need rights. But we need morality. We need to respect ourselves. We need to, because the holy life the obstacles of holy life are not because of lack of rights, but because lack of morality or of kindness and generosity. Selfishness and conceit are the obstacles to the holy life. And those are the real obstacles to the holy life. So that's a reflection for you to consider, because being an American, one has been brought up to think one has all kinds of rights, and these rights are very important to Americans, so that we're never satisfied, because we always want more rights, and we always think that rights are the most important thing for us, and morality is sometimes totally ignored. In fact, we have a right to be immoral in America, isn't it? I have my right to do what I want, and I'm going to do what I want because it's my right. It's the land of freedom. I have the right to happiness, it says. So I can do what I want, because doing what I want, I think I'm going to be happy if I can do everything I want. And how it affects you, it's none of your business what I do, because I'm a free, independent person with my rights demanding my rights. And this, of course, is a very kind of immature emotional state. You never grow up if that's where you're stuck, if that's the way you feel and look at life from that position of demand on the world, on others. So that the maturing, say, of an individual human being is no longer a demand, but a willingness and a joy in serving and helping and in doing the good and refraining from doing the bad. That is where we find our fulfillment as an active living member of a family, of a society. Contemplating the world that we create, or the conditioned realm, the conditioned dhammas. We can contemplate the fact that the sensory world is an irritating one. Its nature is irritation, agitation, things contact the senses and the body. I mean, there's the sensitive form here that's living and breathing and is always feeling something or other, and that's an irritation to the mind. And that no matter, as long as you're reacting to irritations, you can't have concentrated mind because you're always feeling some kind of discomfort or something. If you know, the idea of concentrating your mind, getting your samadhi, you close your eyes, plug up your ears, go to a sensory deprivation tank, in a cave, anywhere, where you have the least amount of irritation coming at your body and senses. And then when you're not being irritated so much, then you can get a level of tranquility that comes through not just being irritated by everything. So this is the samatha practices of concentrating the mind. We have to go off to places where we can kind of control the environment and try to control it so that there isn't a lot of irritating impingement on us. But then when we're reflecting on the way things are, we recognize that it's actually, it's naturally irritating. It's not a condemnation of the sensory realm, but its very existence and quality is irritating to us. It irritates the mind. So in reflecting in that way, as seeing it not as a complaint, not as a put down of the world, but merely as a reflection for the mind. What is irritation? And you realize that you're constantly being irritated. Too hot, too cold, hunger, having to go to the loo, the pain in the body. If you sit too long, you feel uncomfortable. If you stand too long, if you walk too much, if you even lay down too long, you feel irritated. The way we don't feel any irritation is by sleeping. Sometimes we get addicted to sleep because we aren't consciously being irritated at that time. Or drugs and drink are certainly tempting ways of getting beyond the petty irritations. Then not only do we feel irritation through the senses, but through our minds. We irritate our minds all the time with, I don't like this, I don't like that, and this wasn't right, and I don't approve of this, and why did you ever say that? And we become inner tyrants or nags. There can be an ongoing critic inside one's mind. And this is irritating, to sit here and then the critic starts going, you shouldn't have said that, You're not good enough. No, you're too lazy. You don't put enough effort in. Who do you think you are? No, 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 no. Then it goes in when you start losing, when you're getting really sleepy on an all-night sitting, you kind of, it becomes less rational and more kind of balmy. Things just don't make sense after a while. You think you're going bonkers. So that having a retentive memory, having to remember things, we can create that into an irritation for us, which I would say an animal doesn't have, because they don't have retentive memories. Just like the story of the sheep with the lamb being taken away and the wail, the cry of the ewe, the loss of her baby, her little lamb. And she felt the same anguish or great sorrow of separation from the love. But the next day she couldn't remember it. Where if you do that to a human woman, they'll never forget it. It'll become a kind of a neurotic obsession. It can make them totally ruin their whole lives. If you yanked a human baby away from a mother, like they do lambs from ewes, the human woman would remember it. So she'd suffer the rest of her life. If she didn't practice Dhamma, she would remember that and become maybe obsessed by the memory. Whereas the you wouldn't remember. But would it still experience the same grief that the human woman would experience? This is a reflection for you. The wail and cry of anguish of the you was exact had the same anguish, sorrowful, grief-stricken quality as what you imagine a human woman to have at the same under the same circumstances. Totally heartrending scream and cry. And yet the difference would be after that would be one wouldn't remember and the other would. So our memory is in many ways a great gift, but it's also an endless torture to us, isn't it? Because we remember something horrible like that is hard to forget. You talk to people who've been in the Nazi prison camps under Hitler, and it's really something, you know, they can never forget the horrors and the brutality that they witnessed and experienced. Where if it were a sheep, it would probably be dead by now, the one. Don't live very long, but we live quite long lives, actually. So this is what we, because we have this memory, then it's very important to be very careful and live our lives in ways that we, at least, we're not doing things, horrible things that we'll have to remember. Because we remember usually the bad things, the very best and the very worst. What we tend to not remember is just the ordinary things. Remember the great successes, and we remember a lot of any failure or humiliation or unpleasantness. I mean, especially if it's extreme, that we can always bring it back into our memory. Back into our mind. And so this is why it is so advisable to be mindful and to live in a very careful way rather than just any old way. Just let life happen to you any old way. With that, because you have to, if you do that, then you tend to do things that you regret later and that you will remember. So memory can drive us crazy. We can go be completely neurotic, completely out of touch with anything real, just through remembering things. We can create things in our mind, we can fantasize, we can create a whole illusory world that no one else, most of our illusions, people share. I mean, society has agreed upon certain illusions we call normality, and good citizenship, and so forth. But then there are have private worlds that so that we have a creative mind, don't we can create things with it. We can remember. We have the ability. We have memory. We have the creative imagination. We have memory. We have rationality and reason, logic, and we have intuition. And of those four, the intuitive side tends to be the least developed and the least understood in modern humanity. This is how I see it. The intuitive mind tends to have been either rejected or if we're suspicious of it, we tend to think it's unreal or it's untrustworthy. So we want everything kind of labeled and put down as in categories, in computerized systems, everything neatly filed away on floppy disks now, not in file cabinets, floppy disks. And modern technology is allowing our dream to come true. Order everything, put everything in a system, systematize everything, and that's wonderful, isn't it? We can have it all listed under the alphabet. Everything in the whole universe will be under A to Z. What a success story that is, and we'll have names for everything. We'll increase our intelligence, our IQs, our intelligent quotient, by doing all kinds of things to our brains, maybe taking certain pills and certain kind of genes and implants and brain transplants and who knows what, just to increase our ability to retain more names and labels for everything, and to be kind of be more kind of immediate, automatic in their delivery. So you push the button and blah, 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 like a computer. We love creativity and imagination, isn't it? We think that's wonderful to be a creative artist, even though what we create isn't worth a hoot. And even would be best if you didn't bother, as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Because, I mean, oftentimes what we imagine and create is just from our conceit and our stupidity. So even our creativity tends to take a form that is quite presumptuous and conceited and self-centered. Like art now tends to... one sees the art world very much as a kind of full of conceited people who want to make a name for themselves, who really have to write their name on everything and say, this is my creation. Have exhibitions, say, these are my creations, and this is mine, I've done all this. Aren't I creative? Aren't I talented? Because we can. Be quite skillful in the way we use things and so forth, but say, what would be creativity with wisdom? What would be intelligence and intellect, reason with wisdom? What would that be like? Would our memories be such irritating things to us if there was wisdom along with it? So contemplate that. Would these abilities we have, would they turn on, like they tend to turn on us and overwhelm us and drive us crazy or make us unhappy or discontented, when it's coming out of ignorance and self-conceit. Even the most creative talents suffer enormously if when it's coming from a selfish intention. But then what would these be like if there's wisdom? And this is what we're contemplating on this retreat, is how to bring wisdom into our lives, so that our memories are not just experiences of guilt and remorse and depression, so that our creativity can be of great benefit to all sentient beings, so that our intelligence, our intellect, cannot be just a source of fault finding and comparing and blaming, but of being able to tell the real from the unreal, being able to discriminate the true from the false, the right from the wrong, as we experience life, so that our discriminative faculties are working for us rather than against us. And then intuitively, this is developing this ability, this total sensitivity, because the intuition, if taken the personality out of the intuition, the idea that it's personal, then that is a connecting to universality. Because on the intuitive level, we're one. There's not two. But on the level of memory and imagination and reason and logic, we're endlessly dividing everything up, and it tends to make everything seem very separate, very alien to us. We feel isolated and alienated and lonely through our attachments to these discriminative functions of the mind. And even if we happen to be intuitive, quite naturally intuitive, we tend to interpret it from the wrong view. So even intuition makes us super sensitive, and we're easily feeling everything too much. If you meet really intuitive people, they suffer enormously because they are taking it all in the wrong way. They tend to pick up and feel everything, and then see, interpret it in a selfish way. So they become, they're super sensitive and suffer from all kinds of things that people who aren't intuitive would never even notice or feel. But it's through this intuitiveness or mindfulness, awareness, wisdom, that there is no suffering. And it's always immediate. Whenever there's mindfulness, there's no suffering. Whenever there's heedlessness, there is suffering. Right now, one heedless moment, there's suffering. Mindful moment, no suffering. But I don't expect you to believe it. This is for your contemplation, so that you can actually apply this to your own experience as you begin to develop your practice, you contemplate this. And when there's mindfulness, awareness, and use of wise recollection, I can't find any suffering in my mind at all. Not a speck. But then, if I get carried away with something, I start, oh, I can't stand it. I don't like that. No. You're suffering again, tomato. At least when you practice, you begin to develop the way of non-suffering, because there isn't, ultimately there's no suffering at all. There is no such thing as suffering. It's based on illusions. But it's through investigating the illusory, the suffering that we believe in and we react to and we identify with, that we understand it, let it go, realize non-suffering. That's the sequence. Through understanding suffering, we let it go, and then we realize non-suffering. So that the Buddha aimed his point, investigate suffering, understand it, and through that you'll let go of it. And through letting go of suffering, you realize non-suffering. So I'll end my talk this evening.